Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about food, but not just food, food through the lens of taste. Can taste be a lens? I don't know. Well, maybe we'll talk about that today. But because we think that taste matters, duh. That's why we called the show that, because taste isn't just about, you know, personal enjoyment, although that's certainly a part of it, but taste is really about a larger cultural phenomenon. And increasingly I find myself in meetings, as I was just the other day, actually. We have a guest who's, we're gonna be talking a little bit about Spanish food today, and I'll tell you who in a moment, but we were with some chefs from the Basque Culinary Center and some chefs from around the country, and it becomes clear when you get a group of chefs together that taste is really it's really a way to move through the world, that actually discernment and paying attention to details and thinking about what you like, not just because it's yummy or because it's good, but because of the intricacies of the complexities of flavor and how that flavor is produced and where the ingredients come from and all those sorts of things, really reflect a much broader vision of the world, almost a value system. Dan Barber was trying to tell this group at Stone Barns. And that through, I mean, lately it's come to, I've come to realize that actually taste is a really effective tool against the commodification of food. That if you're thinking about wheat, for instance, which we were talking a lot about this weekend with Steve Jones, who's a wheat geneticist, that if you think about wheat, which has been bred to be nothing more than fluffy, tasteless starch so that it can be traded on a free market of commodities, that's one way to approach the world. But if you think of wheat as this many varied, thousand variety grain that can do all sorts of different things and contain all sorts of complexities of flavor, if you approach it from that way, if you approach it from the matter of taste, then it reflects a whole different way of looking at the world. And so that's why we talk about it here. And today I'm excited to welcome to the studio someone who thinks a lot about taste and flavor and actually a lot of the implications of that on our health and well-being. And I'm sitting here with Seamus Mullen, who you may know as the chef of Tertulia, chef and owner, which is a great restaurant. You could walk by it, actually, if you were just walking up and down Sixth Avenue in Greenwich Village, because it's nondescript by design in some ways. It's supposed to look like it's always been there and that it's always just been a site of wonderful tastes and fun and flavor. But it's a lot more than that, and we'll learn why from Seamus. But he's also the author of a really interesting book, which is a beautiful cookbook full of delicious recipes. I was salivating doing the research, getting ready for this conversation. But it's called Hero Food, and it's Hero Food for a very specific reason, not just about taste, but the implications of the ingredients and the food that you eat on our personal health. So first off, thank you for being here, Seamus.
Thanks for having me, Mitchell. It's really nice to be here again.
We are so excited to have you in the studio. I want to take a few steps back, and I want to start about Spanish food, because I've just spent this time with Spanish chefs, and I think that in New York, Spanish food is such a funny thing. It seems so underrepresented or perhaps misunderstood. And like, A, why do you have a Spanish restaurant? Uh-huh. And B, like, what has that been like trying to introduce, as I know you've done for years, a sort of modern idea of Spanish food that isn't two for one lobsters and soggy paella?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, first and foremost, the reason I have a Spanish restaurant is obviously because my name is Seamus Mullen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
makes sense.
Makes complete sense. I spent a lot of time in Spain going back, starting more than 20 years ago. My senior year in high school was an exchange program, and I slowly kind of, I think it's funny, as you were talking about taste, my mind started going, and I'm excited to talk about taste with you, because I think that's a really cool topic. But taste is actually one of those things that brought me to fall in love with Spain. I grew up in Vermont on a small farm, an organic farm, and you know, I was very aware of other cultures growing up, kind of intellectually, because I had my parents were very well educated, and they really wanted my brother and I to sort of have eye-opening experiences. But we grew up in a very rural environment, and when I went to Spain at 16, it was really the first time that I had really kind of experienced not only another culture, but a culture. Mm. One of the things about the U.S. is that we, you know, we're an amalgamation of a lot of different cultures. And I really didn't have that strong cultural identity, whether it's growing up as an Irish American or growing up as a Jewish American or growing up as an Italian American. Right. I didn't have that connection to another place. Mm. I had the connection to the place where I lived. And going to Spain, I started to explore all these flavors and tastes that really, really started a journey for me, and made me, over the course of the next 20 years, want to continue to explore that and bring a lot of the things that I learned over the years living in Spain and cooking in Spain back to the U.S. Hmm. And to talk about your question about why Spanish food has been sort of underrepresented here in the U.S., if you think about it just from a cultural context, and I think this is something else we can talk about in terms of taste really is sort of it's a huge part of culture. Mm-hmm. And food is obviously, I think food and language and music are kind of the vehicles of culture. Mm-hmm. And they're the preservation methods of culture and the evolution of culture. And Spain never really had a large emigration of Spaniards to the U.S. There are pockets, but relative to other European cultures, where you certainly had a huge Italian emigration flow of immigrants to the U.S., who brought and created a network of Italian food and Italian products. And it was very easy to kind of export that from Italy to the U.S. because it already existed here in many ways. Spain didn't really have that. So it took time, and it's taken time. And there's also, pardon me, there's also been the very easy to kind of confuse correlation between the other Spanish-speaking countries of the world. So that while the foods and cultures, there are parallels, many of the ingredients are different, and many of the foods are different.
Right. And that does complicate things sometimes, as Koreans and Japanese are often misconstrued somehow in the system.
In the culinary world, absolutely, right. Yeah.
So you went to Spain and sort of had an awakening, a cultural awakening, let's say, both to the I would imagine the way food is part of life there, as well as the flavors and the sort of the interest of the chefs cooking ingredients. Where did you cook, or how did you then get into the kitchen?
Pardon me. Well, the first place I cooked in Spain was in the kitchen of my host mother's apartment. And that was amazing because I was, you know, again, I was 16 years old, and I had been cooking with my grandmother since I was very little. I've been cooking. I can't remember not cooking. I've been cooking all my life. Wow. To me, it's like, you know, putting on your shoes and walking down the street. I just feel like cooking is just what you do. Mm-hmm. It's part of what you do, part of what I do. So my first experience was really cooking with my host mother, who was totally thrilled because her kids had no interest in cooking whatsoever. Oh. They loved her food, and they loved that she cooked, and she cooked every single meal. I lived there for a year, and I only remember going to maybe one restaurant the whole time. Oh. We ate at home all the time. They had a little house in the country, and we'd go there on the weekends, and we'd do big grills where we'd grill whole lamb and things like that. And, that was kind of my first experience, and I really there were all these ingredients to me at the time that were really esoteric and exotic, and they were things like squid and octopus and
not a lot of octopus
shrimp.
In Vermont.
Not a lot of octopus in Vermont. No, our idea of I ate a lot of trout growing up, which was great. Sure. We had wonderful trout, but outside of that, my world of fish was really not. I didn't eat a lot of fish until I went to Spain, and then I started eating a lot of seafood, and I really fell in love with it, which was something that obviously opened my eyes up to a whole world of flavors. And then I went back to Spain and spent 2 years in my university in Spain, in southern Spain, and I worked in a little tapas bar and just very simple stuff around food. I mean, one of the things that I love about Spain is that even if you go into a tapas bar, the guys that are pouring wine are also bearing little dishes for you. It's kind of like everybody knows how to do it.
Right. You find that in Italy also.
Yeah,
even like if you don't cook, you know how to throw together a delicious Italian meal.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And then as I evolved and decided that I finished university and decided I was going to be a cook, After a few years cooking in the U.S., it kind of made sense that I go and really learn in Spain. So I went back and I lived in San Sebastian for a year and cooked at Mugaritz, and then I went to Barcelona and cooked at Abac and Alquimia, and two great restaurants in Barcelona. So I really started to get a foundation in Spanish cuisine then.
Right. So for a lot of people who came to Spanish food late, the entryway was sort of El Bulli and Ferran Adrià or Mugaritz, this sort of hyper-technical, conceptual, to a point, emotional, whatever you want to call it. I know they all hate molecular gastronomy, but let's use that word.
Sure.
And in some ways, I mean, obviously you worked in that environment, but what you brought to us isn't really that.
It's not that, no.
Yeah. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, what I kind of like to think of this, and maybe this isn't a term that I made up, and I don't know if it's a good term or not, but I like to think of it as the fertile middle ground of Spanish cuisine. Mm. You have your very accessible tapas, much of which is not very good in Spain, and then you have your uber high-end food. And those are kind of the two things that most people are familiar with. And then in the middle, you have all this amazing product. I mean, that seafood that I was talking about, incredible seafood, rice, vegetables, all this amazing stuff. Obviously, the ham and cured meats and cheeses, olive oil, olives, goes on and the list goes on and on. And a lot of that was the food that I was eating at home when I was living there, particularly when I was living with a family. And then I started to discover, pardon me, getting over a little bit of a cough. I started to discover that as I was cooking there, that there were a lot of restaurants that were really focused on that kind of, that what we call in Spanish, cocina de producto, which means product-based cooking. And over the years now, that style has become much more appealing. But what I really, when I went to Spain, I went because I wanted a foundation. I wasn't sure that, I mean, I was interested in the vanguard, without a doubt, and that certainly has been, as you said, it was sort of the entryway for a lot of people to Spanish cuisine. But that was also very, very tied to the economy.
Interesting.
You look at this, you look at Spain, pre-1992 was almost a third world country.
Right.
And then the Olympics sort of started everything.
You're reminding me I was on my Eurail pass in college, the tracks changed when you took the train, and then suddenly they had to get smaller chassis, and people with chickens got on the train, from France, and you just were like, wait a second, I thought this was Europe. And,
It was very, I mean, I remember that's when I was first in Spain, and the expo in Seville in Sevilla in 1992 was a huge step forward for the country, and the economy started to grow, and as it integrated into the European community, it grew, and sort of simultaneously you had this growing movement of modern cuisine, if you will. And I think that a lot of it started actually in the 70s and in the early 80s in San Sebastian with the Culinary Congress of the great chefs, of Arsac and Berasategui and all of the chefs in the Basque Country who did so much to kind of react to Nouvelle Cuisine in France and say, wait, we can do this with our own food, but we're not going to be bridled by the conventions of French cuisine.
Right.
And at the same time, Ferran was just doing his own thing. And Ferran was very much, and again, talk about somebody who was obsessed with taste. Mm-hmm. He was very much interested in just exploring the limits of taste and pushing it. And he worked very hard for very, very many years with absolutely, almost bankrupt, barely getting by. And then the economy started to flourish.
Let's just remind people, that's barely getting by at the most famous restaurant in the world.
In the world, exactly.
Yeah, anyway,
No, I remember when I was at Mugaritz and I was talking with Andoni, Luis Aluriz, who's the chef and owner of Mugaritz, and he was telling me about it. When he worked at El Bulli in the 90s, he said, I remember many, many nights when we would do zero covers.
Wow.
Everybody would come to the kitchen, everybody would make food, they'd get ready and they'd be on their stations and they'd wait all night long and nobody would come.
That amazing.
So it's... excuse me. It was one of those things that then the economy blew up, and before the bubble in 2008, you had this rise, this kind of incredible, stellar rise of Spanish cuisine, and everybody got to know it, but nobody really understood that much of this cuisine is really rooted in very traditional home cooking, and that's kind of what I wanted to bring to New York as best as I could, Obviously, not being a Spaniard, there's some advantages and some disadvantages. Mm. I didn't grow up with tortilla española from the minute I was born, but at the same time, I'm not tied down to the conventions of what my right. grandmother's tortilla española was, and I can say, okay, well, we're in New York. Maybe we have these beautiful ramps in the spring. Maybe that would be really good in it, for right. instance. So there's
and you did grow up presumably eating fresh eggs and delicious
exactly,
potatoes.
Yeah,
and
so it's not, right. that, not a stretch.
Right.
Yeah.
We're going to take a brief break. I'm talking to Seamus Mullen, who's the chef and owner of Tertulia in New York City and also the author of Hero Food. You're listening to Taste Matters.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Seamus Mullen, who's the chef and owner of Tertulia here in New York City, and also the author of Hero Food. And before we get into the next part of our conversation, I want to remind people listening live that you can call us with questions. Our number here at the radio station is 718-497-2128. If you prefer to write or tweet, you can also do that. Or if you're listening to the podcast, you can do that, and we'll try to get your answers on the air in a later episode or get them directly to Seamus if they're for him. And the email address is info@heritageradionetwork.org, and our Twitter handle is TasteMattersHRN. So let's go back to something you mentioned earlier and the conversation about taste that we started the show with and talk a little bit about the relationship that you see anyway between taste and more broadly food and our physical well-being. And I mean that from the point of pleasure and also from the point of specifically medical health. I know you've had some issues. Mm-hmm. We can talk about them or talk about the book a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. I know. I think this is a really interesting it's an interesting topic. Food is incredibly important to me, and I've been living with rheumatoid arthritis for a number of years, which is a chronic inflammatory disease. It's an autoimmune disease. And over the course of the past few years, I've really started to see a huge correlation between how the disease behaves and what I eat. Mm. And there have been lots of things that I've found have really helped me and other things that have not. And I've kind of recently, in the past year, gotten to a point where I feel better than I felt in 10 years. I'm much healthier than I've been. My bloods show that I'm much healthier. I've really gotten to control this disease. And that's been primarily without medication. Hmm. It's been with food, with lifestyle. And that kind of, with that notion in mind, it takes me, I was thinking about this as you started talking about taste, it makes me think about kind of our relationship with food and our relationship with taste. And if you imagine taste in a very kind of primal, as a primal sense, going back now 15, 20,000 years, mm-hmm. our ancestors really relied upon taste to tell them what they should be eating and what they shouldn't be mm-hmm. eating. It was sort of the first, maybe not necessarily the first marker of what was good for us, poison ivy, getting a rash.
Right, but once it got yeah. into you, right,
yeah, exactly.
whether or not you should swallow.
Exactly.
Right.
So that was kind of interesting. And you brought up something really, really, really poignant that it now in today's age, our flavor profiles have changed quite a bit. And the sort of tastes that are often associated with things that are very good for us, we've lost our taste for.
Right, like bitter greens or mm-hmm. or strong, I don't know, flavors of wheat or whole yeah. grains or stuff like that. One of the things most interesting, this came up at the meeting of the Basque chefs, but also I have had Josh Skeens on the show from Saison in San Francisco, and at the meal there, it was so clear that he was playing with bitter in the flavor profile of the food, and it was all still delicious. I mean, I happen to be someone who likes bitter, but it made you realize that you don't get that flavor a lot, or we avoid it somehow, especially in America. In other places, they prize it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had wonderful meals in Thailand, and also wonderful meals at Andy Ricker's restaurant, where you have these herbs that are incredibly bitter, and on their own, it's a very interesting experience just having something that's so bitter. But then, in complement to other ingredients within the food, it really is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And bitter is something that, I mean, obviously in Asian cuisine you have bitter gourd, and you have lots of things it's a profile that you still find in Chinese and Korean and Japanese food and in Cambodian and Laotian food. I've had it as well. But yeah, it's something that we've kind of lost our palate for.
Right. It's one of those things. I mean, I go off on this a lot. I'm so opposed to sort of building taste, building new foods using market research, or the focus group, I think, is the beginning and the end of taste in America. Because,
yes,
of course, if you're given a pile of something bitter or a pile of something sweet, you want it to be sweet. Yep. And if you make that sweet thing crunchy, you want it to be even more sweet and more crunchy.
Yep.
And yet when you think about the complexity of flavor that we're talking about, or all the elements, the opposite of bitter is not necessarily sweet. You know, sometimes it's salty, or sometimes it's spicy. And you work with those things as a chef to really balance them without losing any one thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it turns out that it's even healthier for you.
Yeah.
It's nice to know.
No, I think often, you know, you touched on something really interesting too in saying if we think of the opposite of bitter as being sweet, well, sweet is really one of those things that, particularly in our culture, has really affected our, not only our food, but our health primarily. I had a very interesting conversation the other day with my good friend Bill Gifford, who's a writer and a journalist and brilliant guy, and we were talking about the kind of the health epidemic that we're dealing with in this country right now, and I was a little, you know, and I don't want to be conspiracy theorist, but it's like there's entities that make us sick and entities that profit from it.
Right.
And he said, well, you're not that far off. You know, if you think about sugar and the history of sugar in the U.S., there were a handful of families that controlled sugar in Florida for many, many years, and they controlled the price of sugar. And then in the 1940s and 50s, scientists started to figure out how to extract sugar products from corn. And suddenly it went from 4 or 5 families to 20 to 100 to 1,000 families, and the price of sugar plummeted because we had high fructose corn syrup.
Right.
And they started to, you know, scientists and big agribusiness started to figure out ways of getting that high fructose corn syrup into more and more products. And it had two effects. One, people liked it more, because sugar is one of those things that we've determined it behaves very similar to opiates, and that your body adjusts to it, and you go through the same sort of neurological response of producing serotonin and feeling good when you eat sugar, but then you need more.
Right.
And it creates this
this
health crisis.
We had a neurologist on the show, Gordon Shepherd, who had... he's a famous neurologist from Yale, and he had diagrams of the brain on Oreos, which stimulate it more than cocaine, actually. Oreos actually do
it's
more
crazy.
In there. Yeah.
And then you need them. And the thing is that, obviously, there's, without getting into too much of the science, there's a lot that goes on in your body physiologically when you eat sugar. Obviously, your pancreas needs to work overtime to regulate your insulin levels. Your body stores fat and doesn't burn it. Mm-hmm. Those calories are not accessible. So, you know, we've seen as sugar has kind of made its way into our palate and into our food and across the board, and you'll see it in anything that ends in os, whether it's dextrose, you name it, anything that ends in os, that's, and if you look at nearly any processed food, you're going to find it in there.
Right.
And it's one of those things that it always blows my mind when I look at, you know, a healthy organic yogurt in the morning, and I turn around and I see it's got 25 grams of sugar.
Yeah.
For those of you who are not familiar with the metric scale, that's about 13 teaspoons of sugar.
Right, amazing.
In your cup.
And we began by talking about sort of the your first arrival in Spain and the realization that this was a culture there. And I wonder if we could get back to that, thinking about some of these issues and the change. And one of the things I think is so challenging for us, and may just be a factor of time, is that as the country that is made up of all of these people from different cultures, you know, trying to figure out what American food culture is has, if there is one, and, you know, at the Beard Foundation we like to assert that there is and has the potential for one, is difficult, but also it's really important. I mean, to develop a relationship of food that is culture-based, that it's about an identity and our values and our tastes and who we are, that eating what we are, what we eat is who we are, in a way that is certainly true in Spain and mm-hmm. in Japan and in countries with long evolved food cultures. And so I wonder if you, I mean, not to put you on the spot, but could talk about what, you know, what as a chef of a Spanish restaurant in New York City, mm-hmm. you think you can help educate or help put food into into that important place in our culture. If you have mm-hmm. some ideas about that for people listening.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that I want to respond to is that we do often, I mean, I think we're living in a very good, wonderful time from a culinary standpoint in the U.S. Really sure. wonderful time. There's an ever-increasing interest in food, both good and bad, but I think for the most part, there's an ever-increasing interest in food, which is great. The more people are more curious about where their food comes from, they don't just accept that the food ends up on the plate. They want to know the story. They mm-hmm. want to know where it's coming from. And I think that's very important. But we often, when we become sort of self-deprecating Americans, we often hold other culinary cultures on a pedestal. And we say, look at the purity of Japanese cuisine and look at the relationship of food in Spain. Mm-hmm. And we forget that, wait a second, these are all cultures that have been highly influenced by other cultures, and they're always evolving. Tempura mm-hmm. was brought to Japan by the Portuguese. Tomatoes, which are a fundamental part of Italian and Spanish cuisine, are a new product in both Italy and Spain. So remember that we're always evolving. All cultures are evolving. It's a process. Life is kind of about the journey.
Right.
And you can never take a snapshot and say, this is the essence of this food culture. And I think in that sense, we're in that process too.
Right.
And our evolution is going to be, and it is, much more complex, and in many ways, I think, much more interesting than a lot of other food cultures, in so much as that we have the most plural society in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're just a couple miles away from Queens, which is like the absolute epicenter of multiculturalism in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all of these different traditions coming together, and they don't always just mash up and turn into something else that's American, but they're all affecting each other. They're all kind of rubbing off on each other. And in that sense, there's just a really beautiful increasing awareness. And particularly for those of us that live in New York that are fortunate enough to live here, we're really exposed to wonderful things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on all the time.
You're seeing it everywhere. You don't even have to qualify that anymore
yeah.
to say, at least we live in New York. You go to Nashville or Minneapolis or all these places around the country, and you just see these really dynamic food cultures.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Yeah, it's really amazing. So 2 minutes about the book itself
mm-hmm.
and what a hero food is or mm-hmm. why it's hero food, and just a little bit about some of the, I mean, when you flip through, obviously the book is organized into some specific ingredients that are there for a reason, but it looks like a wonderful Spanish cookbook to me mm-hmm. with recipes that make my mouth water. So
yeah.
a little bit about that project.
Well, I mean, it was a very cathartic experience for me writing the book, and it was really about, okay, these are things that have helped me and that are helping me and that are a part of my life. And how can I then share that with other people that could be living with the same sort of situation that I am, but could just be concerned with taking care of themselves? It really was, as I said, it was a very kind of healing experience mm-hmm. writing the book. The book really for me was about trying to dispel this myth or this burden that's been kind of that health food or healthy food has been bridled with for so long. We've been saddled with this notion that healthy food is not delicious food. And
we were just,
it's just the wrong thing.
Remembering the smell of a health food store from the 70s
yes,
recently
exactly.
with some friends, that mix of vitamin and lecithin and plastic
yep.
and horribleness.
Yeah.
trying to get that out of your
yeah,
mind.
And, yeah. And then the guy who's at the checkout counter that looks like the most unhealthy.
Gonna die.
yeah, exactly.
Any minute.
So it's really, and it's amazing. And we've been sold so much misinformation over the years, and we're just starting to understand it. I mean, the 1970s and the 80s with the whole, the low fat issue was just, it's just complete misinformation. Low mm-hmm. fat does not keep you from gaining weight and does not make you healthy. It concentrates more sugars in whatever it is that you're consuming, and fats are very important, and fats don't make you fat, and
right.
they just have to be the right fats. And so we're starting to understand that, okay, a lot of these great things that are really delicious, like, I mean, I was actually just writing a recipe this morning for a dish that we're doing tomorrow, which is anchovies with avocado and olive oil and garlic and a little bit of espalette pepper and on a rye crisp that we're doing. And that's a pretty simple and very approachable and delicious thing that happens to be extraordinarily good for you.
Right.
And that was really the premise of the book for me, mm-hmm. that good food and healthy food and real food can be delicious. It should be delicious. If it's not delicious, and to get to the other point we didn't touch on with taste is pleasure.
Right.
If you don't enjoy pleasure, if you don't enjoy the food, if you're not deriving pleasure from it, and there's a lot of very strong, compelling evidence to show that our physical well-being has a lot to do with our emotional well-being. Mm-hmm. Just look at the levels of cortisol and stress. When we talk about the stress hormone, lower levels of cortisol help your body recover, help you rest, help you get over disease. But if you get that from pleasure, from joy.
Right.
And so that there's a real important value. And that's why, like, I wouldn't say, you know, if you love eating donuts, have a great donut periodically.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
You get a lot of pleasure from it. Just don't when it becomes routine, then you stop deriving pleasure from it, and all you're getting is the bad part. You're not getting the good part.
Well, and I think that's a great place to stop on a show named Taste Matters, because there's good parts and bad parts, and taste will help get us through them. Thank you so much for being with us, Seamus.
Thanks for having me. It's been really, really fun.
Really nice to have you here. Next week, we will welcome someone with a different set of memories, but an interesting cultural experience, Anya von Bremsen, who's a great food writer and restaurant critic, traveled around the world, speaks many languages. Great dear friend, has written a memoir about largely about growing up in communist Russia and her family's story there. Unbelievable. It's a page turner. I'm still turning the pages. I'll be done by next week when she's here, but hard to imagine a very different way of looking at the world and food and the values that come with food. So we'll be looking forward to talking with Anya in the meantime. Before then, why don't you go have some tapas, even if you didn't grow up eating tortilla española every day, and think about the flavor and the culture that is behind that and how it contributes to everybody's well-being. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.